Democracy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, brothers and sisters, we are talking in this episode about the importance of knowledge of the self and also about the different levels of nafs. We have been talking about this issue during the past few episodes as well. But in this session, inshallah, we are going to cover the nafsi lawama, the blaming self. And as we said in the previous episode, that a person may rise to the second level, from the nafsi ammara to the second level, which is nafsi lawama, the blaming self. And when he rises, then changes do take place, transition will take place. Obviously, you know, arrogance, pride are transformed into humility, and vengefulness and hate are transformed into love, and anger is transformed into kindness once this transition takes place. Now, brothers and sisters, when it comes to nafs al-lawama, the Quran says, وَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِالنَّفْسِ al-lawama. Now, you can go to the Holy Quran, you can find chapter Qiyamah, and verse 2 of this chapter refers to Nafs al-Lawama. And the translation of this verse, وَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِالنَّفْسِ al-Lawama, is such, Nay, I swear by the self-accusing soul. Let's have a break, we will be back.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program For a Better Life. We are discussing Ma'rifat al-Nafs, self-knowledge. And now, what is this self-accusing soul, or what is this self-reproaching soul? Or maybe we can translate it as self-blaming soul. This is the second stage of the nafs, and an important stage of the nafs. Of course, you can say the second step in the development of man. When man becomes aware of his actions, when he is able to differentiate right from wrong and regrets his wrongdoings, this is where he is. And this is when he rises to this station, he begins to become aware of his actions. He begins to regret his wrongdoings. That's what lawama means. But when he begins redeeming himself and regretting his past actions, he is not able to totally stop doing wrong things, because it's very difficult to break the habits of his previous state. He tries to follow the obligations of his religion, and he prays, he fasts, he pays alms and tries to behave properly. But he is at a critical juncture. He is at a critical stage. He does actually good deeds, but he is struggling and fighting with his conscience, because his soul or he himself wants to be known as a reformed person. He publicizes his piety, his good deeds. That's the stage where he is. And he expects appreciation from people, but his conscience blames him. He regrets. His conscience reproaches him. And this makes his behavior hypocritical, you know. Sometimes he realizes this, regrets it, and tries to change. Hypocrisy is the principal danger in this level, in this stage. And it is said that conscience plays a key role in this struggle of the nafs. Some scholars have even given the name nafs lawama to conscience, and they're saying that nafs lawama is the same conscience which is now fully, you know, fully active, and it constantly blames and accuses the individual for failing to fulfill his obligations. There are two grave dangers as well at this stage: arrogance and anger. Every little attempt to be good compared to the previous state seems like a major achievement. So we think we are the best and get angry with others who do not seem to respect us. Arrogance, hypocrisy, anger, intolerance, and lying to ourselves can overtake us. And that's why I'm saying that it is a critical stage. At the level of nafs lawama, the devil tries to influence us in one way or the other. It whispers into our ears, "You are as good as your teacher, you are as good as such and such people. Not only do you know as much as they do, the way you behave is better." And this is the whispering of the shaitan. If they were able to apply what they teach in their own lives, they wouldn't be half what you are, you know. You don't need their preaching or their advice. Now let people see your wisdom and your deeds, so that you will be an example of them. This is kind of devilish whispering. The whisperings of the devil, but all worldly life is against the seeker of the perfection at this stage. Brothers and sisters, you know, nafs lawama is a self, is the nafs that is in constant fluctuation between obedience and disobedience. Sometimes it is heedless and falls, and another time it is aware and resists. So this is the natural station which we start from at birth, and from there we descend and or ascend. Its sign is the fluctuation between the characteristics of the people of this world and the people of the next world. The self-accusing nafs or nafs lawama is higher in stage than nafs ammara. This is what Allama Tabatabai says. And it's lower than the nafs mutmainna, of course. This is the stage of salvation for the self. And the first step towards it is purification and it is success. It is a critical stage, but it is a positive step taken forward towards perfection, towards betterment, and towards salvation. Allama Tabatabai says in his Tafsir al-Mizan that nafs lawama refers to the soul of the mu'min that blames and accuses him for failing to fulfill his duties to Allah, for failing to fulfill his obligations to Allah. And it's the nafs that continuously blames him and accuses him and reproaches him for lethargy, for laziness to Allah, and for committing sins. And that's what, brothers and sisters, nafs lawama is. Lawam means blaming. Lawama means accusing. Lawama means reproaching. And this is a positive step. As I said, this is a positive step taken forward towards perfection, towards betterment. Now, it is a stage higher than nafs ammara, but it's a stage lower than nafs mutmainna, which, inshallah, we will try to discuss in the following episode. But inshallah, till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
The Limelight.
The warmongering policies of the United States, whether in West Asia and East Europe, or in the South China Sea and Latin America, may trap its allies and client states into a quagmire from which it will be hard for them to extricate, says Kahan International staff writer in an article published under the heading U.S. warmongering poses dangers to world peace. Stay tuned for more. The warmongering policies of the United States, whether in West Asia and East Europe or in the South China Sea and Latin America, may trap its allies and client states into a quagmire from which it will be hard for them to extricate. Saudi Arabia is already feeling the folly of its headlong plunge into Yemen at the behest of Washington with a heavy drain on its treasury, while the flames of the unwanted war are now about to boomerang on the UAE, which, with the weapons bought from the US, tried to punch above its size. The US ought to know that it has no right to dictate its draconian policies to the free and independent countries, whether by sending troops to Europe to kick up the crisis in Ukraine or its current Navy drills in West Asia, along with such strange bedfellows as the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia. The deployment of U.S. troops in Eastern Europe on the pretext that Russia might invade Ukraine augurs ill for all NATO members in case if the dangerous exchange of threats were to break out into a real military confrontation. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has criticized the U.S. and the West for creating unnecessary panic by the histrionic talk of a probable Russian invasion, saying that the economy of his country has already begun to suffer. Such policies definitely destabilize not only Ukraine, but the whole of Eastern Europe, even if the Joe Biden regime says there is no imminent danger of Russian invasion. Then why and on what basis the US and other NATO members are pushing Eastern Europe to the brink of disaster? In the South China Sea, we see the same brinksmanship by the US by poking its bloodied nose into Taiwan, which is a purely internal Chinese affair. Moreover, the presence of US troops in South Korea and Japan bodes ill for these countries in case of a military flare-up. The same could be said of Washington's meddling policies in Latin America, where, at the moment, no effort is being spared to destabilize Venezuela, which, thanks to its leadership and the popularity it commands among the masses, has foiled successive US conspiracies. Colombia stands to suffer greatly if the Americans were to carry out threats of military adventure in Venezuela. In West Asia, tensions are increasing as a result of unnatural bonds into which the U.S. has pushed some of its Arab client states with the illegal Zionist entity. Now, the military drills involving the Americans, the Israelis, and some Arab states that kicked off on January 31st at the U.S. 5th Fleet's headquarters in Bahrain is a dangerous exercise. The waters of the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Oman, the Red Sea, and the northern tip of the Indian Ocean have turned into a virtual war zone. Participants include a number of countries that the Zionist regime does not have formal ties with, such as Saudi Arabia, Oman, Comoros, Djibouti, Somalia, and Pakistan, as well as several countries with which the regime recently normalized relations, like the UAE and Bahrain.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
Tensions between the West and Russia remain high, with the United States and its allies accusing Moscow of planning an invasion on its Western neighbor, Ukraine, and Russia denying all the accusations. The tensions are already starting to hurt Europe, which is largely dependent on Russian gas. The threats of sanctions on Russia are raising fears about a possible disruption of supply and demand in the energy market. There have been other factors at play too. The cold winter, low gas storage levels, high European Union carbon prices, fewer liquefied natural gas tanker deliveries due to higher demand from Asia, lower than normal Russian gas supplies, and infrastructure outages are all cited as reasons why the continent is facing a potential energy crisis.
The crisis which we have is in part self-made by the European Union because they have allowed their storages to run pretty empty in winter time. This is crazy. And there's another story from the EU side, which is unprecedented, I think, in world's history, that there's a double pipeline brand new, ready to deliver on Germany's shores, coming directly from Russia. And we are refusing to use that second double pipeline.
That explains rising energy prices across the continent, with benchmark European gas prices at the Dutch TTF hub rising by 330% last year, while benchmark German and French power contracts have more than doubled. The United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up to as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames the matter on the rise in energy bills. Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach a record 7% in April. What the European countries can't deny is that they need Russian gas. Take Germany, for example, which is expecting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project to become operational. The pipeline would potentially supply 26 million German households. But the United States might be the one to prevent that from happening.
The notion that Nord Stream 2 would go forward with an invasion by the Russians is just not going to happen.
This is the situation, and it's Europe which is not, you know, trying to make a good connection with Russia and see to it that Nord Stream 2 starts producing, starts delivering. This is the situation. It's a crazy situation. And I think there is no situation like this in human history that the goods are ready, but the victim refuses the goods because there's a stronger guy behind, like Washington, like the US, stopping us.
The US has been warning of what it calls an imminent Russian attack on Ukraine, despite Ukrainian officials' statements that suggest the contrary. Some NATO members are reluctantly backing Washington on this. But the Europeans are the ones who will have to bear the consequences of any conflict or tension on the continent, and not the US. Then, diplomacy and dialogue seem to be the only feasible options between the two sides, as further tensions won't be in anyone's interest.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi assalam. Amir al-Mu'mineen understood that in order to establish justice, to give people their rights, to establish equality and equity amongst people, he needs to be in a position of power, because it will be very hard trying to establish these things without having the upper hand. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi has been given a golden opportunity to lead and rule the Muslims after the third Khalifa, and he was pressured by the Muslims themselves to lead them. He made it very clear to them that I only will take and assume office if I establish justice on all of you without any exception. It doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are from, your lineage, your tribe, justice will fall on everybody equally. There are no masters, there are no slaves. Under the government of Ali, everyone is equal, either a brother in faith or equal in humanity. No injustice, no oppression. And he did so. Therefore, in order to understand the nature of Amir al-Mu'mineen's administration and his economic and financial policies, it is necessary to learn how Imam Ali alayhi salam himself has explained the Khilafa and mastership. What position Khilafa enjoys from the religious point of view, and what benefit does it carry in its lap? So it does not come free. There are things that we need to look at. When Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi tried to explain the concept of Khilafa al-Mastership to people, in one of his speeches, he was saying to people at the time that taking oath and allegiance from them and them giving it to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he said to them from the first day, he said, "O people, I am one of you. I enjoy the same rights which you enjoy. My responsibilities are also the same as yours. Nothing can invalidate truth." Now, simply Amir al-Mu'mineen in this statement, he's trying to bring himself and the title that he assumed, which is the office, rulership, and mastership of the Muslims, he says, that position does not give me the chance or the right to be above you or to be different from you, or gives me more right than you guys do, or my responsibilities will become any less than you. So he's basically saying to them, whether I am a khalifa, a ruler or not, that will not make a difference. I should be one of you. Now, this is in the view of Ali alayhi salam. Is this the matter with all the kings, rulers, prime ministers, presidents, mayors, and governors, and even on a smaller scale? Is that how the case is? No, Of course not. When a person assumes position, he automatically gives himself a higher rank than people. He walks with a bulletproof car, with bodyguards, and he does not communicate with common people anymore. No one can get to him, and so on and so forth. So you can see the difference between them and Ali. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we said that Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he came to power, he made it clear that he wants to rule them with justice, fairness, and equality. And there is no man higher than other. Even him, being in a position of power, he is still one of them. He enjoys what they enjoy. The same responsibilities that falls on them falls on him. Unlike that those who preceded him, where they put themselves in a position of leadership and kingship, or those who came during his time and after him, like the Bani Umayyads, who made themselves kings, and obviously they separated themselves. So you had the separation of classes, where people now, they have to bow before them, they have to give them respect, and in some cases, they have to give them complete servitude. They have to be their complete servants. But Ali alayhi salam was different, because what was in his mind is the interest of people. If you want to serve people, if you want to serve humanity, if you want to give humanity a hope and a chance to live a happy and prosperous life, you must become one of them. You have to live amongst them. You have to feel their pain and their suffering. You have to see it firsthand. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he used to walk in the streets of Kufa every single day and make sure that everything was going fine. And a lot of people, even in Kufa, they did not know it was Ali alayhi salam. So he would go around and he would advise people. He would try to make sure that people are, you know, their affairs are met and no one is oppressing anyone. So he was amongst them. He used to sit with them. He used to walk with them. He did not have any bodyguards. He did not have, bulletproof horses or caravans or what have you. No, he was as simple and normal as them. He dresses the same way they dress, eats even much less than what they eat, lives in something more humble than what they live in. So he lived the life of a common person. He dealt with them as a common person. He came down to their level. Anyone could come to him, anyone could speak to him. And these are the qualities of true leaders. Those who always worry about people, the safety of people, the welfare of people, and the happiness of people, not their own. So you can see that when it comes to matters of rulership, you can see that Amir al-Mu'mineen was an exception through the course of history, where no one did what he did. Even the just rulers and just kings, we had some of those throughout the course of history, but they never came down to the level of people. They never walked in the streets as commoners. They never dealt with people as commoners. They always referred to themselves as kings, and they are doing people a favor by applying justice. This is not Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. He was an example for all mankind until the Day of Judgment. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala
محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Cultural news Social news Scientific news Artistic news With the light
Biologists in Peru release two birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. Two birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tonga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered five traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the Games. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khojouri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis-sized, tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope.
www.parstoday.com/en